I wish I could wear sunglasses and white pants in quite the same way as Jeffrey Donovan.
I just wish I could wear a suit in the heat without melting.
Fair point.
Live from Mundangerous Studios in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 1 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
You know we're not live.
Yeah, I know. But it sounds way cooler if you say we're live.
It's okay.
Ishan, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Shane?
I'm good. I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited about our topic for tonight.
Is it going to steal the show? And what is that topic today, Shane?
Tonight's topic is heists and heist encounters.
Ah, yes. A little B&E.
Yeah, exactly. Why don't you tell us or tell our listeners, what is a heist encounter?
You've probably run these or played through these already without necessarily calling it a heist encounter. You need something. Someone doesn't want to give it to you. You don't want to kick in the door and murder everybody. What you want is to obtain it without being found out. You're going to break in. You're going to sneak around, you're going to steal something, and you're going to disappear.
So it's a scene from Ocean's 11, or The Italian Job.
The Great Train Robbery.
Or my personal guilty pleasure, Burn Notice.
That's yet another thing we have in common.
I mean, seriously, it's so good. Every episode, a new break-in. It's like the poor man's Ocean's 11.
You know, spies.
All right, so why are we discussing heists today?
Well, they're often overlooked by GMs, especially in D&D. In fact, there's not even a section on them in the DMG for 5e.
Yeah, so why are they so difficult to pull off?
A heist is basically a gauntlet of puzzles, and any DM knows that even just one puzzle is very difficult to make happen in the right way, especially if the party needs to get through it. You make it simple, they're going to make it complicated and screw it up. You make it complicated, they're going to find a simple way to get around it, something that you missed.
The other problem is you've got dice, right? How do you handle a group that fails? If you blow that stealth check and you get caught by the guards, now what?
Yeah, do you really want to be in the position of having to run an encounter where they're fighting their way through the guards? Maybe that fits into the plan for the game, but maybe it doesn't. Planning a heist encounter is different from planning a typical encounter. In a typical encounter, you can just roll with the punches. If they fail to bluff the guard, maybe they're going to get into a fight. But often in a heist, you're facing the party with impossible odds. They're breaking into the vault that cannot be broken into. They are stealing the crown jewels.
Right. It's the type of thing where if you could just fight your way to it, you would, but it's going to be hard to do that, so you find an alternative approach.
Right. The heist exists because it is the only way the party has a possibility of succeeding.
You know, how do you ensure that every player has a chance to shine? If I play the fighter who's good at fighting, and we're playing tonight's session with the intent of avoiding every fight, how do you make sure that I enjoy that session as well?
Well, part of the responsibility falls on the players, but we'll talk about a few things that GMs can do to make it easier for their players to shine in appropriate moments. Because remember, you haven't necessarily figured out a quote-unquote correct answer to solve each of these puzzles. So one of the answers might be, oh, there's a sentry. Well, he needs to be taken out in one round. Well, that's the fighter's job.
Right.
And as we'll see when we talk about the Pit of Five Sorrows, the heist that we ran in the Morning Glory campaign, the fighters really came through.
So before we get into that, let's talk about the phases of a heist encounter. First, you've got the planning phase, where the party is gathering intelligence, they're trying to understand their opposition, and they're planning their approach for acquiring whatever their target objective is. Then they have the infiltration phase, which is where they're actually putting their plan into motion and overcoming the defenses to acquire the objective. Then they have the escape phase, where they need to get it away safely. And finally, they have the fallout phase, where the characters and the world around them feel the impact of their success or failure. If the characters have that shiny MacGuffin that they needed to take down the Lich King, or if the world now has to react to the fact that the crown jewels have gone missing.
So let's talk about the heist that I ran you guys through in the Morning Glory campaign, the Pit of Five Sorrows.
Or the Draconian Job.
Bastion's 11.
Yeah, so why don't you explain to our listeners what the Pit of Five Sorrows was?
In Eberron, the Pit of Five Sorrows is Tiamat's tomb. In canon, she is one of the fiendish overlords who has power over dragons. She eventually corrupts all of them. So she was bound deep in the Underdark, what's called Khyber in Eberron. And she's guarded over by dragons day and night for, I guess, the past 100,000 years.
And our objective in going into the Pit of Sorrows, right, was we needed to add a couple artifacts to the defenses against Tiamat, right?
Well, the party's real objective was to gain the trust of the Chamber, a group of dragons who weren't interested in killing and eating any humanoid they encountered. You needed their help in order to unravel the Draconic Prophecy, and they needed your help, but they also wanted you to prove yourselves. Dragons don't like going near Tiamat because she eventually corrupts them, even if they're good. So who better to do their dirty work than little insignificant humanoids?
Six non-dragons.
It also gave an opportunity to run an encounter where the party was punching above its weight. In 3.5, I believe the pit was basically specced for level 35 characters. Obviously, that one's going to happen in 5e, so I was able to bring it down in level just a little bit, but the party knew that if they screwed up, they were just all dead.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. And I think we're going to be able to put all of the details of the pit itself and the defenses that we had to tackle. We'll be able to put those on the website. Everyone can see those. We'll link those on the show notes. If you look at it, I mean, there were just a crazy amount of permanent spells as well as two pretty badass tomb guardians, I guess.
I had a lot of fun designing both of them. It was nice to not have to worry about encounter balance because there was just no way that you guys were going to be able to face them head on. And you weren't going to be able to stumble into the pit without knowing what was going on because you would just fall apart. That's the point of it. It's a prison. And when attempting to either break into or out of it, it's designed to prevent you from achieving your objective. Fortunately, this is where planning comes in.
Yeah, and I think the way that you handled it worked really well for us. To a degree, you kind of took out the gather intel phase of planning just by having the chamber provide all of the information that we wanted and needed about the pit. But you sent us an email the week beforehand and basically said, here are the challenges you're up against. You'll have a couple hours to plan it in the session, but you should get started now because it's really hard.
Yeah, that's another thing that I don't like about heists. Sometimes players get so involved in planning and doing it the right way that all your time's gone. 3 hours have passed and now everyone has to go home. So sending an email a week ahead of time is a nice way for people who have a little bit of extra time to sort of get their bearings, and the party can at least agree via email on a general method of attack.
We're going to link this, but obviously most listeners won't bother clicking that, and I don't blame you. But a couple of the sort of the highlights of the defenses that made it a challenge for us at level 15, teleportation was not an option either into or out of, so we had to plan around that. There were alarms that triggered anytime anyone other than dragons entered. Every room was brightly lit as if by daylight. All of the doors were locked and were gigantic. So it was really difficult to even open a door. They were dragon-sized doors, and we were human-sized people. The guardians themselves were obviously a huge challenge. And then each room had its own purpose and then also its own special challenge in it. There was a room that just had a permanent anti-magic field. There was a room that had walls of force that triggered as soon as you entered. So there, it was basically like a prison. There was a room that had ninth level dispel magic on anyone who entered. There was a labyrinth built in. There was a room, I think, that had frightful presence triggered.
Yeah, frightful presence. There was a zone of truth, prismatic walls, walls of force. It was really nice for me to be able to leaf through the spell book and pick the worst stuff that I could think of to throw at you guys.
Yeah, and so it became kind of a challenge of pick our approach and then figure out what's the best way to not fail whatever check was coming. You know, things like dispel magic basically meant we couldn't go through there, whereas the labyrinth, we had to figure out a way to boost our odds of succeeding there lest we get stuck in the labyrinth. And I think we also figured out a way to lie to the zone of truth.
Yes.
So there's that.
With high-level parties, it's almost impossible to predict what their abilities will enable them to do or what they'll be able to overcome. You also can't predict exactly what idea they're going to come up with. So it's really just best to set the scene in front of them and let them figure it out themselves.
Yeah, but what about lower level parties? That worked for us because we were level 15, but let's say we were less capable, maybe level 4 or 5, where it was very possible to give us a challenge that we simply couldn't have overcome. What are some tips to keep in consideration there?
I think the same general rules apply. It's up to the party to figure out how to overcome this challenge. And if that means that they need to do a lot more prep work and a lot more planning before they actually begin the infiltration phase, so be it.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a GM, you have to keep that in mind. Maybe there's a side quest or some particular gear, you know, another MacGuffin that will help them, that they can take more time in that planning phase to go chase that down. And maybe that's an encounter that you have, or even a session that you have before the actual heist encounter.
Right. And of course, at high levels, it doesn't make sense in game for the dragons to have overlooked some obvious way in to the prison of Tiamat. But, you know, if you're talking about a bank at the edge of town, there's probably something that they can figure out.
Keep in mind, logical defenses are built around the most likely thief. Even in the real world, banks don't even really try and defend their vaults. They just have alarms and insurance.
Which is actually why the party in the Morning Glory campaign was perfectly set up to break into the Pit of Five Sorrows. You weren't dragons. They were scared of dragons and fiends. They weren't really defenses based around stopping humanoids.
Oh, and there was something else that you did that I thought was really helpful. You know, we had kind of established that, one, dragons didn't really care much for humanoids, and that dragons are inherently magical and also really big hoarders by kind of their character. So they had a large storehouse, library, armories worth of magic items. And so you basically made the whole DMG available to us for options to use. So we were able to basically raid for scrolls and potions and those types of things to sort of supplement our abilities.
Yeah, so while a lot of the gathering intel aspect was already taken care of for you guys because the dragons gave you all this information on your target, the planning phase was still very important for you guys. In fact, I'd say it was maybe even a little more difficult because you had so many options.
Yeah, which is actually how it led to us spending a week on email planning and then getting to the session and throwing it out. We overlooked the monk's crazy fast speed. And frankly, kind of discounted the sheer size of the pit. Like you said, it was roughly a quarter mile. It just wasn't practical for us to move at human speeds. So that became kind of central to our approach, was we can get really fast.
Right. There was a lot that you guys overlooked initially. And I think this is one of the instances where it really does behoove a DM to really know their material. So your bard in session was making intelligence checks about certain types of spells or things like that. And you guys as players don't necessarily know that Nistel's magic aura probably works really well in this particular scenario, or if you cast glibness, maybe you can get by the zone of truth. But I knew those things, and with successful intelligence checks and arcana checks, your characters knew those things.
And then I think another thing that you did that made it really useful, first, you set a hard limit on our planning. When we got there, we ordered food, and you basically said, look, at 9 o'clock, we're starting this heist. You have 2 hours. Do your planning, do the best you can, and then we're going. And everyone kind of looked around and was like, is he kidding? Is he serious? 2 hours isn't enough time. And then you introduced a mechanic that I think was really clever that should absolutely be used in every campaign. You basically gave us all a poker chip. You said they were basically flashback chips, which would be that scene where the group encounters a challenge that the viewing audience of the movie, for example, didn't necessarily see coming. And then you cut to a flashback scene of them going, well, what if this happens? Ah, we have this contingency plan. And so when we traded in those chips, it gave us the ability to say, oh, we didn't see this coming. Good thing we got that potion of such and such to take care of that. And I think that's how we got glibness.
That's how you got a lot of things. Yeah, absolutely. Each player got one opportunity to pull a flashback out of their ass. If you think cinematically, you've broken into the prison and, oh no, there are guard dogs. And we didn't expect that there would be guard dogs. Except, oh wait, flashback. Remember when we did expect that there would be guard dogs and someone brought
meat?
Yeah.
a T-bone steak. That's how you distract guard dogs, right?
Obviously, that's exactly what you do.
It worked, the 101 Dalmatians?
It worked in Legend of Zelda.
Or Legends of Zelda.
GMs, I want to be very clear. Your players are going to try to abuse this system. Don't let them. This isn't like in Fate with, what are they called?
Fate points.
Fate points, yes, thank you. Where you can change the direction of the story. It is literally just a flashback. It's not even a retcon. So if, for example, you open the door and a guard sees you, you can't drop your chip to say, oh, it actually turns out that the guard didn't see me. It doesn't let you reroll, nothing like that. What it does let you do is say, oh, do you remember 5 minutes ago actually when I cast invisibility? Yeah, of course all of you do. Actually, no, I remember that's not the case.
No, it would have been like, do you remember when I had that stun gun?
Right. It's a mechanic that I think I want to use actually more often in my games generally, because it introduces an interesting strategic dynamic that's also still fun. And it also prevents the campaign from getting bogged down in planning and minutia.
So Ishan, what are some tips for designing the objectives for a heist? What are some things to keep in mind?
If you're a lucky GM, your players will do that for you. If you're not, well, there's always going to be an opportunity. There's going to be something that your party wants. And it's your job to keep it away from them.
Yeah, but how do you make a heist more appealing than just attacking outright?
I think questions like this are often handled better in-game. Maybe the repercussions for attacking from the front are more than your party can handle. Maybe they want to save face. Maybe they want to blame it on someone else.
Or maybe like the owner can't know that their special item is gone. It's basically Ocean's 12, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that was the bad Ocean's movie.
Are we counting Ocean's 13?
Ocean's 13 was fine. It was back to the formula.
It was okay.
At least the theft actually mattered. Ocean's 12 was like, here's a whole thing that we did. Oh, by the way, none of this is important. It's already gone.
Let's just focus on 11. Let's the right. Original. The original is where it's at.
Right.
The original remake.
Yeah, not the Rat Pack one. That one was just okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another idea is to include secondary objectives. If the MacGuffin is the main objective, you know, the plot important item, maybe there's something along the way in the same facility, for example, that's important to one of the players.
That's one of the reasons that I put a prophetic observatory inside the Pit of Five Sorrows. Lou, the warlock, was very invested in increasing her divination abilities, so this was an opportunity for her, along with the library.
And it actually was kind of a point of contention within the party, as she wanted to stick around and stare at the stars, and we wanted to get out.
You guys did get another prophecy out of it.
It's true. But I feel like maybe you would have found a way to put that in our hands anyway.
It's possible, although it was a prophecy about how to defeat one of the guardians, the Omnimental created from multiple breath weapons of dragons.
Yeah, we'll talk about that problem in a minute. So let's talk about intelligence gathering. What are some ideas for sources of intel that the players can track down or that the GM can provide?
Well, almost every game has a gather information or streetwise skill, and hopefully someone in the party is trained in that. Of course, you've got your typical bars and taverns. You've got rogues. Lots of times there are contact network options for feats or talents.
Yeah, I mean, you've got other people who have a stake in the score, right? The person who puts you up to the heist, perhaps the buyer for the target, or in our case, the chamber itself.
Right. It's often an inside job in some way.
Right, right. Or like a personal rival, right? That was Ocean's 13.
Right. And of course, one of my personal favorite tropes is the old thief who's now retired, who just wasn't quite able to get their hands on whatever it is you're now after.
Yeah. Lamarck from Ocean's 12.
We're going to keep coming back to that. All right.
What are some ideas for documents that could be available?
Well, my personal favorite, prophecies. They're especially old or iconic set pieces. There's almost always some sort of lore about the location. If they're magical, that's even easier to come up with.
Yeah, and in less magical settings, in a more modern or perhaps more realistic, you've got blueprints or official filings. You've got to file your architectural planning with the city. If you go and pull those from the file, you can learn a lot about what's inside.
If you're running Shadowrun or Eclipse Phase, you can just check the internet.
Yeah, and then as part of that, you have to tailor it sort of to your setting, but local lore. If you talk about the famous vault at the bank that's never been cracked. I'm sure there's lots of people who are happy to spread rumors or maybe even news coverage about what happened.
My favorite part about this phase and planning this sort of information is that you can really tailor it to your party. So prophecies have a way of dealing with the PCs, of involving them in some way and giving them just the kind of information that they need, but in a way that's difficult to understand.
Like the Indiana Jones prophecy, legend.
We're not talking about Crystal Skull, are we? Because that didn't happen.
Oh, Last Crusade.
Ah. While trying to uncover these documents, your party's also probably going to run across people who know more than they think they know. People who become unwitting accomplices. You've got drunken guards, maybe you seduce them, maybe you blackmail them.
Yeah, and then you've also got talking to the person who designed the defenses. Maybe that person has a little bit of a hubris problem. He's bragging about what he did for them and giving you the information just unknowingly.
Of course, that's not going to help you if your opponent has read the Evil Overlord list or has any knowledge of Greek mythology, because the designer is, of course, the first person who goes in the prison.
Yeah, I mean, that's just good security protocol. What about posing as a potential buyer for the safe or the vault that the object's kept in?
Yeah, that can totally work. The great thing about all of this is there are so many different ways to get the information. You don't need to come up with them. Your players do.
Yeah, and that's the thing is if a player comes to you and says, hey, maybe we could go talk to a security consultant and see, you know, he doesn't know anything about this specifically, but if you were going to design something to safeguard the crown jewels, what do you think you would do? And you can just roll with it. That character doesn't have to exist as an option. Just roll with whatever your party's looking for to make sure that they have the information that they need.
Yeah, whatever they're looking for, whatever they want, it exists. It's just a question of whether they can get their hands on that too.
So how much information should you share with the players though?
It's really up to you, depending on the kind of session that you want to run and the scenario in game. I shared nearly all of the information with you guys about the Pit of Five Sorrows. In fact, I even mocked up and gave you handouts of the stat block entries for both of the guardians, which was actually a bit of a gamble on my part because it meant you would know exactly if you hit and exactly you could calculate the chances that they would have to hit you.
I mean, what that really did was it emphasized the planning. We went in with less of a need to improv once we got into the actual running of the heist.
It also gave me an opportunity to sort of wash my hands of throwing something too difficult at you because you knew exactly what you were getting into. And if the adamantine dragon forged uses its cursed attacks to reduce your HP until you take a long rest, there's no whining about it because you knew it was coming.
I still would have whined, but that is fair.
I mean, you did run this session without your paladin, which I was kind of planning on when I built that creature.
So I think for most situations, a DM isn't going to want to give their players perfect information, right? You're going to have some level of incomplete. There's going to be some unknown for the players. To me, I think there's kind of two distinctions. One is they know what they don't know, and then there's where they don't know what they don't know. So that's the difference between, say, Ocean's 13, when the group didn't know how they were going to get access to the diamonds, and they gambled on whether or not Matt Damon's character would be able to seduce the assistant who did have access, versus the Italian Job, when they planned to steal the gold from the house, but they didn't know that the neighbors were having a party that night. Or when they pivoted and tried to steal the gold from the truck, they didn't expect that there were going to be two decoy trucks as well that they needed to deal with.
That's a good point. While I gave you the stat blocks for both of the guardians, you didn't necessarily know where in the pit they were going to be when you were in.
And frankly, that was one of the biggest challenges. And I think what made it such a tense encounter for us was that we never knew when we were going to open a door and find the Omnimental staring at us. And when that happened, we weren't sure what we were going to do.
It was the fifth door, I believe.
But I think at that point, we just decided to scramble. We had previously been carried by our monk, and he basically threw us in one direction and ran in the other direction. And we weren't sure what was going to happen from that point, and that's what made it so tense. You know, the plan had come together perfectly up to that point, and then the moment that our perfect information broke down, one, the poker chips became very handy to retcon the stuff that we needed, and two, the tension ratcheted up.
And that's different than flawed information, which is, of course, one of the most often used tools in the GM's toolkit.
Yeah, that's when you're giving them deliberately incorrect information, or you've just omitted something that's important. This is like in Reservoir Dogs. Nobody knew that Mr. Orange was an undercover cop.
Spoiler alert.
And I think that really emphasizes improv, and it really takes away from the planning. So if you're going to do that, that's fine, but don't give your players 2 hours to plan if you know you're going to throw it out the window in the first 15 minutes.
It was like in our Dark Heresy game, which I don't run. We were planning how to infiltrate a spaceship. Of course, the GM knew that as soon as we approached it, it was just going to explode. So rather than have us waste 2 hours of our actual lives figuring out how to get on board this ship, he just had it explode.
I mean, that just threw a wrench in our half-cocked plan, but saved us a bunch of time, and I was really thankful for that.
Yeah. Now, as a GM, you should make sure that your players don't know the difference between false information and complete information. They may think they have everything, but they should always wonder how much of what they've been given is actually true.
Yeah, so where do you think the sweet spot is? Obviously, it depends on the group, but for your personal preference, what's the right balance for you?
I'm sort of mean, but I really like letting players feel like they are completely prepared, that they have all the information that they need. So that means sometimes that rolls will be done in secret so that if, you know, they get a low roll, they think, ah, yes, I've absolutely discovered all the documents that are available. But you know that they haven't. I want them feeling confident so that when in some way it inevitably unravels, it'll be a surprise and it'll be tense.
Yeah, so you basically want all of your carefully laid plans to turn into a Coen Brothers movie.
Not always. I want there to be the chance that it could.
Well, I think I want to know what I don't know. I think I want to have the chance of that perfectly pulled off plan. That real, like, Ocean's 11 final scene when they realize that they've been had from the very beginning. Like, I want to pull that off as a player. And I mean, I've never done it. Our plan has always gone awry at some point or another. But I want to have the ability someday.
I think it should always be an option, obviously depending on the dice and how well the players plan. But, of course, the players are always planning for that. That is always the goal on the player's end of it, right? To sort of have a perfect game.
Well, not for all players. I mean, some players just want to get the planning over with, start rolling the dice, and knock some heads together if they have to.
But even if they like had their way, I'd say that they'd still roll really well and that the outcome would essentially be the same.
Yeah, fair enough. But a perfectly executed combat, that's just a heist that turned into a combat. That's not really a perfectly executed heist, right?
Depends on your player. I'd say Bastion, the Warforged monk, was happy that there ended up being more for him to do.
At this point, we should probably just talk about how we solved our particular approach. Using the monk's speed and using, I believe, reduction potions.
And an enlarged spell.
And an enlarged spell. We made him as fast as possible as he was using key points to speed along through the tomb. And then
you made him large enough to carry all of you in sacks on his back.
Right.
Yeah, I'll say that the way that you guys skirted around most of the defenses that I placed was definitely surprising. But that's something that I look forward to. You know, when you're designing defenses, it's often this sort of tug of war between what would be logical for there to be in place and what will be challenging for the party.
Yeah, so what are some ideas for defenses that the GM should consider when they're putting together their heist?
I think they basically fall into two categories, passive and active. Passive, of course, means things like alarms, things that are mindless or automatons or always respond in the same way. Traps, things like that, puzzles. If the party has been able to gather enough intel, though, they are going to know what they're up against, they're going to know how to respond to them, and then they can get around them relatively easily. Active ones, of course, things like guards or even, you know, an intelligent AI that can respond in real time. And of course, your players are doing the same thing. They're responding in real time. So active defenses are important to have so that you as a GM can respond in a way that makes sense in game to what your players are doing.
One of the things you mentioned earlier was for us to fool the zone of truth, we passed an intelligence check and learned about the glibness spell, which gave us the ability to bypass that, which in a way is sort of your system mastery of fifth edition shining through. So what about the DMs who aren't system masters, who don't have all that ingrained knowledge? When I started DMing, I certainly didn't know everything in the player's handbook and how they interacted and all of that years of tradition of D&D. So how can you, as a DM, how can you help mitigate that?
First, I'd say I would lean more heavily on active defensives. That enables you to improvise more when your players come up with things. It also means that there's not necessarily like a proper way to overcome the defenses. So you don't want to be stuck with a rules lawyer telling you that the information you sent us tells us that there's an easy way to circumvent this with a second level spell. Maybe they're right, but now there goes your encounter. And I think coupled with that, it's also good to impress upon them that they don't have all the information, or for them to find out very early in after it's already too late for them to go get more information. Maybe the first or second room doesn't look at all like what they were told it's supposed to look like. And now you've introduced this bit of uncertainty that you can use to change things as you need to in order to keep them on their toes.
Yeah, I think it's just important to foreshadow that. Drop the hint that they have incomplete information and that they don't know what's right and what isn't. You can emphasize that, you know, there's redundant defenses, or there have been recent updates or changes, or that your sources are particularly unreliable. The drunken guard is one thing. The old thief who's falling over himself in a tavern, he colors his information completely differently.
I think those are definitely good options. I would only warn that if you have a particular kind of player, if they feel at all not confident, they're just going to stall. So you've got to make sure that there's some sort of hard deadline that gets them in there. This needs to be taken care of before the full moon. It's going to be moved tomorrow. They're going to kill all the hostages, something like that.
Well, if you're going to move it tomorrow, then they're going to try and steal it while it's moving, right? I mean, they should just be waiting for it to move.
Maybe it's getting teleported. See, I just made that up. Improvisation.
Fair enough. So what about when it comes to running the encounter?
So we've already talked about setting a real life hard timer. Right? Don't let them plan for more than an hour, 2 hours, something like that. And then segue into flashback tokens, letting them plan sort of on the fly while you're still running the encounter. It's important to remember that you don't need to run a full simulation with any of this stuff. I mean, any session that you're running.
That's something that D&D doesn't always make clear to new GMs as well. You don't have to simulate everything. You don't need to know where every guard is at every moment. Sometimes just a closed door is enough to say, hey, there's a guard there now.
Right. And if you don't know, well, that's what dice are for.
Yeah, that's the fair way to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
Though
I like to have magically teleporting guards.
I think another good thing to do is keep track of the elapsed time in-game. So let your players know periodically, okay, you guys have been inside the vault for 5 minutes, or you have been inside the palace now for 25 minutes. And just giving them the periodic updates of how long this has been going on heightens the dramatic tension, even if that time doesn't mean anything to you. The fact that the players believe that there's a timer ticking will impress upon them the need for urgency.
It's also an opportunity for you to let them see that the location is alive and responsive. So your passive defenses, while they don't think about things, they are probably on some sort of timer, or they change every hour or every 5 minutes or something like that. The lasers keep moving. The automatons keep walking clockwise in a circle. And of course, your active defenses are going about their lives, going about their jobs. It's good to remind your players, hey, great, yeah, you want to stand here in a quiet corner where you don't think anyone's going to find you for 5 more minutes? That sounds great, but there's an excellent chance a guard's going to walk down the hall.
Exactly. And I feel like this debate has been going on since the D&D Next playtest, but let's talk about gridded maps versus theater of the mind, because I think it's almost kind of becoming a point of religion when it comes to 5e players, but for our group, we use both gridded maps for combat as well as Theater of the Mind. And when we ran the Pit of Five Sorrows, you had decided to actually printed out a gridded map that gave us the chance to actually track our movement space by space. So what influenced that decision for you, and why was that important for you in that instance?
I think because I was giving all of you such detailed handouts, it seemed a little strange to sort of have a hand-drawn map of, oh, this is sort of approximately what it looks like. You were dealing with dragons who either knew of or had access to the information that was used to build the place. So they essentially had the blueprints. So why wouldn't they just give you those blueprints? I will say, like I said earlier, the entire structure is about a quarter mile square. So if we'd had enough space, I would have loved to have printed out the entire thing and had you move minis square by square, because I think that would have impressed upon you the vastness of the scale of the things that you were dealing with, right? You can't move this door because it's literally 10 squares wide.
Right.
But putting that on a grid and then sort of printing it out for you guys on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, you can still look at it and go, oh, okay, that's really, really big. And then we could use Theater of the Mind to say, okay, it's going to take you 3 rounds to get to the next room. The Guardian gets to the next room in 1 round. What do you do?
And so let's talk about the map, because the map is conspicuously missing from the materials that we're uploading.
Oh, yeah, maybe that's because I kind of stole it.
And where did you repurpose it from?
I started with the map from Vault of the Dracolich, the D&D Next adventure. I needed a big map with a hole in it because it's the pit, right? Tiamat is in a giant kyber shard inside the pit, and the vault has an excellent crevasse. So I just took it into Photoshop and filled it with fire. I cut off all the water on the left side. I cut off the long room on the right and the top two on the north end, which gave me a relatively squarish, somewhat compact group of rooms. I took it into Photoshop, closed off all of the edges so it was completely self-contained except for the front entrance, and began with that. From there, for those of you who have the map, you can see that there are plenty of features on it. I am not a Photoshop wizard, so I tried to incorporate as many of those features as I could. So the first room is red. I think that's supposed to be blood, and there's a skull. I cloned out the skull, but I couldn't make the whole room not red, so guess what? That's an anti-magic field. There's a pentagram in one of the other rooms. Guess what? That's the prophetic observatory. There's a dragon skull in the upper left. That is now a shrine to Orlanastrix. There's a full dragon. That's now a shrine to Sybaris. Yeah, it was relatively easy to repurpose it for whatever I needed it to be. And the features that were already there really informed what I decided would be in each room.
Yeah, so if you're interested in running the Pit of Five Sorrows in your own campaign, unfortunately we can't give you that map, but we have sort of done a hand-drawn reproduction of it that you could go grab the adventure from RPG Now, what is it, like maybe $5, and then you can repurpose the map yourself, and we've numbered the rooms so that it's clear which one is which and which has which defenses. So that's available to you if you'd like.
Of course, once you've achieved your objective, how do you get out? The escape is one of the most important parts of the heist, and it's a part that's often overlooked by particularly greedy adventurers.
So what are some of the ideas, just in general, for types of escapes?
Well, I mean, maybe you come out the way you went in.
Yeah, that's the sneaky approach, right? There's also the sort of more blunt force approach. Just open up to a dramatic chase.
There's the Fiona approach, which is blow a hole in the wall.
That's a Burn Notice reference. And then, because I can't go a whole section of this discussion without mentioning one of the Ocean's movies, there's also the Ocean's 11, in which you completely social engineer and dupe and outplan every single response to everything you do. If you can pull that one off in a game, you're far smarter than your GM, and you should definitely be running.
Strangely, I've never had that happen in a game I've been running. And of course, there's the situation you guys faced when you were trying to get out of the Pit of Five Sorrows, which was combat.
Yeah, this is a natural point to spring a combat on the party, even if it was unexpected, because their objective is much, much simpler now that they already have whatever object they're looking for. If you have an early combat during the heist, it puts the object potentially out of reach. But if it's already in hand, all they have to do is win the combat or sometimes just flee the combat. They don't even necessarily need to fight.
In fact, it's likely that at this point, combat is going to occur simply because the chances that they've successfully infiltrated and have tripped absolutely no alarms and no one has been alerted to their presence are very low.
Yeah, and if they've got the choice of fight or flight, you need to be ready for flight. And the DMG covers this on page 252 when they talk about chase encounters. They've got some good suggestions there that you should absolutely look up just in case your party decides that they're going to beat it.
So what happens when they do beat it? Then what?
Well, if we're talking about the Pit of Five Sorrows, then we escape through a book of planar something or other.
The Manual of the Planes.
A Manual of the Planes. And we wind up running right into a draconic terrorist.
Yes.
By the name of Durasturin, who I don't even know if he's canon.
The name is canon.
The character is not?
Yes.
Okay. So yeah, it turned out that by carrying out the Chamber's plan and proving ourselves to them that we had unwittingly proven that we could overcome the defenses of the Pit of Five Sorrows, and that made Durasturin quite interested as he wanted to spring Tiamat loose and unleash her upon the world.
Hey, you guys are agents of prophecy. This is just what happens. Trouble follows you.
Yeah, and that's when we get to fallout.
There are two general options for fallout, for consequences. One is that the party succeeds, and the other, of course, is that they fail. In the worst-case scenario for the party, that means they're all dead.
Yeah, and that's probably going to be the end of your campaign, but hey, hopefully you went out on a high note.
But let's assume at least one of the party's still alive.
So who's going to be interested in either their success or their failure?
This is an opportunity to circle back around to the beginning, the objective. There was a reason that the party was attempting to break in the first place. So now that they've either succeeded or failed, what happens?
Think about who was harmed by the heist, who lost something, and who would have a vendetta against the party now?
Or if the party got hired, does a friend turn into a foe? Is this the opportunity that you spring combat on them?
Yeah, and think about competing interests. We joked earlier about if they're about to move the object, why not steal it in transit? Well, guess what? If you've just stolen an object from its vault, it's now in transit. If somebody else were interested in it, maybe they try and intercept the party.
Perhaps that's the reason they hired you in the first place.
And then we come back to Durasturin.
That guy wasn't really an enemy. He just wanted to be friends. But for some reason, you guys didn't want to be friends with a body-jumping dragon warlock.
Yeah, so we decided to hop back on our Manual of Planes and go back to the tomb.
Yeah, which was great for me because now the guardians were waiting.
Yeah, and so we had to fight our way out of there.
It worked out pretty well.
We lived, mostly.
Thanks to luck and a prophecy.
Yeah, so for the curious GMs out there, what was the secret to surviving the Omnimental? Because we definitely couldn't have taken him in a full frontal assault.
It was essentially MacGuffin that I gave you guys. Another tool in case you ran into trouble. Again, is I like riddles, and so I gave you a prophecy that Lou saw in the observatory. It's a good thing that she was so intent on going to look at it instead of heading directly for your objective. Essentially, you guys needed to combine certain types of spells at the same time in order to keep the Omnimental off your back, and that gave you enough breathing room, literally breathing room, to make your escape. After that, you were able to head back to the chamber and collect your reward.
Okay, so we've covered some tips for how to prepare heist encounters and some things to think about in terms of objectives, in terms of gathering intelligence and how much information to share, right? We've also gone through the phases of the encounter and how to run them and plan them. Do you have any other parting tips to leave with our listeners?
I think GMs just need to remember that this is an opportunity for them to be creative and inventive. So much of this is about creating an encounter that is geared around your party, that plays both to their strengths and their weaknesses. It's a fun opportunity to see what they're capable of.
So let's move on to the Character Creation Forge.
I'm really excited for this, Shane.
Well, why don't you explain what the Character Creation Forge is?
One of the first things that got Shane and I talking about game mechanics in the first place was character builds. So every week, we're going to take a character concept from outside D&D and build it in 5e, ideally in an unorthodox way. So for our first venture, we are going to build the traditional swashbuckler. However, we won't be using the Unearthed Arcana swashbuckler archetype for the rogue class, nor will we be using the rogue class.
Right, and the key to the character creation forge is this is a character that's playable at every level. So while we're not looking for a min-maxed, overpowered character, we are looking for a character that's going to be fun to play and that won't lag behind in terms of being able to be effective in combat or having things to do outside of combat.
Right. Ultimately, the character creation forge is about playing a character that's fun and feels like it fits the theme that you're looking for.
So when Ishan and I were first kicking around ideas for the swashbuckler, we both kind of settled on the Errol Flynn style of swashbuckler, right? He's the actor from the 30s and 40s. He played Robin Hood. He played Captain Blood. He was in The Seahawk. The hallmark of that sort of swashbuckler is he sort of dances through combat. He barely breaks a sweat. He's has a variety of acrobatic stunts in his arsenal. He's quick-witted and silver-tongued. In more modern adaptations, he's
perhaps epitomized most recently by Captain Jack Sparrow. But touchstones for me are definitely Wesley in The Princess Bride or Zorro, Don Diego de la Vega. So here's how it works. Each of us is independently building a full level 20 character, and we'll walk you through our choices, levels 1 through 20, and different options that you can take. And then we'll sort of discuss pros and cons to each of the builds and how they might differ slightly in playstyle. Shane, why don't you start?
Sure. So I started building off of a fighter, and this was kind of a challenge for me because I wanted to have a bard in there, as the bard has lots of skills available to him and expertise, but he's a little lacking in the combat areas, but is a full spellcaster. I was thinking about the acrobatic stunts and how a lot of those translate well into spells that are available, particularly the low-level utility spells. Things like jump and fly and levitate and blindness, deafness, or featherfall. Those are the kind of spells that you could flavor as, oh, I throw sand in his eyes, now he's blind. Or I stab my dagger into the sail as I fall to break my fall, and that's featherfall. So I wanted to build on a sort of a competent spellcaster base, added into a decent number of fighter levels. So I built a Bard 3, Sorcerer 5, Fighter 12. I started with a Bard at first level that gave three skills of my choice. So I took Acrobatics, Deception, and Intimidate. I took the Entertainer background, which gave Persuasion and Performance. There's a duplicate skill with acrobatics, so you could do that either way. After Bard 1, I took 6 levels of Fighter, the Battlemaster Fighter. And with that, that gives you the extra attack at level 6, which is only 1 level behind normal fighters. And for maneuvers, I chose Riposte, Rally, and Parry. Riposte lets you use your reaction to make an attack on somebody who misses you. Rally uses, I believe, a bonus action and adds temp HP to your allies. And Parry uses your reaction to increase your AC, which sort of dancing through combat, right? From there, I took 2 more levels of Bard. That gives bonus proficiencies, which I took Perception, Insight, and Sleight of Hand, though at that point, it's kind of more to what you think is useful and fits your particular character. And I also get Expertise at that point, so I expertised Acrobatics and Persuasion, giving you double your proficiency bonus on both of those. From there, I took 5 levels of Sorcerer, and then the remaining levels were Fighter. In terms of spells to consider, I went with Shocking Grasp because you'll be a primarily melee spellcaster. Shield to raise your AC as well if Parry won't cut it. Featherfall, Blindness, Deafness, Misty Step, Levitate, Haste, Fly, and Blink. With 5 levels of Sorcerer, you'll be a 3rd level caster. And I think you'll actually have 4th level slots, but you'll know 3rd level spells as a Sorcerer. You'll also, because you're a 12 levels of Fighter, you'll have a number of ability score increases, and I just chose a few feats that I might recommend at different points. Defensive Duelist isn't the strongest feat, but it does fit the theme very well. Lucky is extremely useful, and again, being able to roll those d20s or force a reroll gives you another way of getting your hard-to-hit, sort of very acrobatic, you know, you can do the improbable. Mobile is particularly useful for avoiding opportunity attacks, which kind of, again, that dancing through combat. And then Resilient Con Simply put, you're in melee and you don't have a lot of HP. So as a caster, you've got concentration spells, so that will give you the constitution saving throw proficiency and hopefully give you some extra HP. Though frankly, I would try and find an amulet of health as quickly as possible.
I think the Battlemaster Fighter was a really good choice to emulate the acrobatic stunts and the fancy footwork that we see in the piece. I really like the idea of reflavoring spells to be more impressive feats. And I think with proper spell selection, you can definitely get things that are totally believable. Featherfall works really well for, like you said, falling down the sails.
Which was a Mythbuster thing and not possible, so it must be magic.
That obviously has to be.
Movie magic becomes D&D magic. So one of my concerns is that because you only have fighter 12, you'll never get the fourth attack as a fighter. You'll get the third, but you'll get it at character level 19. So one thing that I wanted to make sure was that because the fighter, with a fighter base, you were giving up a lot of your combat effectiveness, that you had things to do outside of combat to kind of balance that. So you were a little more rounded participant in the party. So do you think I covered that?
Yeah, if you think about the swashbuckler, they're not a fighter, they're a lover. And your builds ended up a lot more of a skill monkey than mine. So you've got expertise persuasion, which I think is certainly going to help off screen.
Yeah, and I took persuasion just because I think persuasion is more universally applicable. Depending on how you want to flavor your swashbuckler, if you're less quick-witted and more silver-tongued, you might want to go with deception.
Or even a blackbeard variety with intimidate.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you build this? You used the monk, right?
I did. So I find it interesting that both of us really gravitated toward mobile melee combatants who had tricks up their sleeve. So the Battlemaster Fighter gives you maneuvers, whereas the monk just has them built into the class. And that's one thing that I really liked about it as a base. But we'll get to some of the other pros of a monk build. So I built Monk 14, Fighter 4, Warlock 2. I think the first thing you'll notice about this build is that it's a little mad, multiple attribute dependent. I think you're going to need to decide whether you're going to do Wisdom secondary or Charisma secondary. In either case, keep both of those at 14 and then focus on Dex.
Yeah, and that's good to note. Should have covered that in mind, is that mine's built primarily off Dex. You would want to use a finesse weapon, probably a rapier. I didn't build it for two-weapon fighting, though you could, but Charisma would definitely be your number two stat.
So I went straight through 5 levels of Monk right off the bat. That gets you your extra attack at level 5. You get Wisdom to AC. You get martial arts and extra attacks. You get ki. You get deflect missiles, so you can chop arrows out of the air. And you get slow fall, which emulates the feather fall and sliding down the mast or sticking your short sword through the sail and landing on the deck without hurting yourself. After that, 2 levels of Warlock is a pretty unorthodox choice, but let me explain. A bit of it is future-proofing. I fully expect that one of these days we're going to get more splat books, or at least more options for things like Warlock invocations. And I remember that in 3.5, one of the best Warlock invocations was Persistent Spider Climb, which would just be amazing on a ship, or really in a lot of different places that a swashbuckler would end up being.
Definitely a forest.
Like forest, balcony at the theater, a chandelier, all those sorts of things. So maybe that'll happen one of these days, maybe not. But there are still a lot of very good invocations available. There's Beguiling Influence, which gives you proficiency in deception and persuasion. Of course, remember, if you took one of those with your background, you can pick any other skill. So it's really just one invocation for 2 free skills. I really like Disguise Self at Will. That is very good. And if you're going low wisdom, you might want to take the invocation that gives you Mage Armor at Will. You also get 2 cantrips. The lazy way to build this is to take Eldritch Blast, but I just really don't see how that fits thematically. It's really, really good mechanically because it scales by character level, so it's just sort of amazing to have, and maybe you have it in your back pocket. But I really prefer something like Prestidigitation, or even Friends, or Blade Ward. This is actually one of the few characters where True Strike might actually make some sense. Two levels of Warlock also gets you two first level spells that usable per encounter. My choices are definitely Charm Person and Hex. Hex is great. It's a bonus action for a little bit of extra damage. However, if you are going with a low charisma build, and that means like charisma 14 and you're not pumping it a whole lot, and you're going high wisdom for the AC, you might want to avoid any Warlock ability that requires a saving throw. So I might just go with Blade Ward and True Strike, and then for first level, take Protection from Evil and Good and Hex. Those, I think, work out really well and still fit thematically. The Swashbuckler just has ways of slipping out of danger or avoiding harm in ways that normal people can't.
Yeah, and likewise with Hex, you've got the chance to do damage on par, be a competent melee combatant.
Another thing that adds to that is the four levels of Fighter. That really just builds to an ability score increase, but you also get Action Surge, you get Second Wind. I mean, do you remember when Count Rugo throws a knife into Inigo Montoya's, it looks like his heart, right? It basically hits him in the stomach. He gets thrown back against the wall, but then he pulls it out of himself and attacks again. What is that if not a Second Wind?
So do you take the champion here?
I absolutely do take champion because the increased threat range synergizes really, really well with the monk's extra attacks.
Because you're trying to fire off as many attacks in a round as possible.
Exactly. And I would flavor all of those as basically pommel strikes. So you're using a short sword, which eventually does as much damage as a rapier anyway. Attacking with short sword and then a strike with the pommel. And then if you need to, a quick trip with the leg using your monk abilities, or you can a swift kick to the solar plexus will kick someone back. After that, it's 9 more levels of monk to round it out. Now, I know this seems like a lot of monk, and a lot of people are sort of wedded to the Eastern flavor of monk, but I think there are a lot of ways to reflavor it.
Yeah, I was going to say, the monk is typically a more of a lawful flavored class, right?
But fortunately, 5e doesn't require them to be. So higher levels of monk get you great things. Oh, open hand, by the way, obviously. You're going Way of the Open Hand, which is what gets you your ability to knock people prone or push them away from you. You get evasion, so you can dodge those fireballs. Stillness of Mind allows the Swashbuckler to snap out of it when the siren call has just been too difficult to ignore. You also get, and I really wanted to build toward this, Purity of Body at level 10, immunity to poisons, which includes Iocane Powder.
Perhaps the most flavorful choice that we have.
Thank you. The other thing that monk gives you is mobility. I don't mean the feet, but it is that monk already builds in everything that you get from the mobility feat, which is good because you only get 4 ASIs with this build. For background, any really works. I prefer custom backgrounds, but I really like the folk hero background feature, which lets you hide from the law amongst common people, or sailor, which lets you gain passage for your party anywhere you need to go. For skills, acrobatics, athletics if you want. Like I said, you can take deception, persuasion, things like that early on, and then get other things with the Warlock Invocation, or just wait. Perception is good. Stealth.
Yeah, I left stealth off and took sleight of hand. It just, I don't know. I guess it's kind of a preference and more of a which particular swashbuckler you're building towards.
Right. I think they're all of these things are easily swappable. And I think that's one of the real strengths of 5e is that it's very hot swappable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Plug and play. All of these, you could trade things from each of these builds. You know, a lot of these choices just sort of depend on your own playstyle and the playstyle of your party. For feats, you definitely wouldn't go wrong only taking ability score increases. Definitely get your dex to 20, and then points in wisdom or charisma are going to help you either way. But if you do decide to take feats, I agree with most of Shane's choices here. Lucky is always a great feat. It's extremely flavorful for the Swashbuckler. You don't need mobile. If your DM is nice and will let you retrain, I would take Resilient Con as well. And then once you hit Monk 14, which doesn't happen until level 20, you get proficiency in all saving throws, so then I would retrain it out.
Yeah, and just at that point, probably just take +2 con, right?
Yeah, potentially. I think that is the weakness of both of these builds, is that none of them is going to have a high con because they just don't have the points for it.
So that's what I tried to build around, by having ways to increase my AC and make myself harder to hit. That's kind of the thing that stands out for me, is because you've got to choose between charisma and wisdom, you're not going to get the full benefit of your monk unarmored defense, right?
Right. Yeah, which is why you have a few more options with warlock, but it definitely is one of the cons. Oh, but definitely go Archfey, because I think that's a lot more flavorful. It also gives the option of Fairy Fire or Sleep as your first level spells. Only go Sleep if you're pumping Charisma. Fairy Fire, you wouldn't necessarily need to, but it does offer a nice party buff for being able to attack.
And that one can be a little bit flavorful as well.
Yeah, I'd say definitely. Basically, you're pointing someone out and say, hey, everyone, get him.
Right.
One other thing to keep in mind is that the monk build of the swashbuckler is fine with no weapons in hand. So that means that if you're at a party and you want to grab a fork and stab someone with that, just flavor it as an unarmed strike. You know, be flavorful with it. Grab the candelabra and bash someone over the head with it. Things like that. Your body is a weapon, which means that anything in your hand is a weapon.
So which one would you rather play?
That's an excellent question. Honestly, and it pains me to say this, I think mechanically I might have more fun with the monk version, but I would feel more like a real swashbuckler if I was playing your version, mainly because like their skills are so good.
Yeah, I was going to say your version definitely seems more combat capable. Mine is a little more pieced together. It's a decent combatant who will hold his own, but he won't be leading in any category for combat. But I think outside of combat, my build has a little more skill options available and can kind of double as the party face. So I think I would rather play that.
Yeah, I think your option, if he finds himself or she finds themselves in combat, they'll feel like they've already failed a little bit.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that about wraps it up for episode 1 of Total Party Thrill. If you'd like to reach us, you can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's at M-U-N Dangerous.
And you can tweet Ishan at Evil Sans Carne.
And if you would like to tweet at the show, we are at Total Party Thrill. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We'll be talking about humble beginnings, starting a campaign off, the planning that needs to be done before you actually start your first session. And then afterward, how do you build the backstory for all these characters? How do you integrate them together, the disparate goals of multiple characters into a single immersive campaign? Where is it taking place? Where do they live? What have they been doing? What is the state of the world that they live in? What town are they from? All these questions that people have to get them invested, to get them feeling like their characters are real people who live in a real world that responds in meaningful ways that make sense.
And in the Character Creation Forge, we'll be discussing Greco-Roman style wrestlers.
We get to build Zangief?
We get to build Zangief. I hope this has indeed been a total party thrill, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.